Hello, and welcome to Creative Playdate, the show for people pursuing creative careers while also raising children. I'm Michelle Condridge. Welcome to the final episode of Season 1 of Creative Playdate. This tiny idea I had over the summer has turned into 15 episodes of wonderful conversations about parenting while pursuing creative careers, and I could not be doing this without everyone who has listened and supported me in one way or another. I will be back with Season 2 in a couple of months, and I've already got some really great interviews lined up. I'm super excited to end the season with cartoonist, author, and educator Jessica Abel. She's the author of incredible graphic novels like La Perdida and Trish Trash, Roller Girl of Mars, and her book, Growing Gills, How to Find Creative Focus When You're Drowning in Your Daily Life, is the kind of resource that many of you might be searching for. She also runs an excellent online workshop called the Creative Focus Workshop, where she helps participants find a sustainable creative practice. If you've got writer's block, you procrastinate too much, you feel unfocused, trust me, there is a resource for you on Jessica's website. I really enjoyed talking to her about how her career and work developed alongside having children, especially when there's a lot you can't plan for. I'm here today with cartoonist, author, and teacher Jessica Abel. Jessica is the creator of comics like La Perdida. Her and her husband Matt Madden were series editors for the Best American Comics. And she's also the author of Growing Gills, How to Find Creative Focus When You're Drowning in Your Daily Life. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
Obviously, I've just scratched the surface of you and your work. Would you mind giving us a bit of background personally and with your work?
Well, I've been a cartoonist for 25 years or so, and I'm currently in the middle of finishing Trish Trash, Roller Girl of Mars, Part 3, which will be the last of the three. I've also done nonfiction work over the years, and I'm a teacher as well. I'm the head of the illustration department at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, and live in Philadelphia, have two kids. Does that cover it? There's lots of stuff.
But. Yeah. So Growing Gills, which I just started reading last week, seems particularly useful for people who are trying to pursue a creative life with children. How did you get into writing about storytelling and creative focus?
Well, those are two very different phases in my life. Writing about storytelling started with teaching comics and needing to teach storytelling. You needed to figure out how to talk about it so that I could, you know, explain it to students and help them do a better job. And I didn't really understand it either. I mean, it really, the learning about it started with my own comics, but then when I started teaching, it became necessary for me to, have language around it. And Matt and I, aside from Best American Comics, also wrote two textbooks about making comics called Drawing Words and Writing Pictures and Mastering Comics. And I think that's the first time I was writing about storytelling. And, in an explicit way. I had written handouts before and talks for students and things. But then in there, we have a chapter on storytelling tools and a chapter on building characters and that sort of thing. So that was when I was really getting it into some kind of codified form. And then predating that, I had done in 99, I did a comic called Radio and Illustrated Guide with Ira Glass of This American Life about how they make their show. Like what are the stages of work that go into putting together This American Life show. And although it's now very old, it's still pretty accurate. You know, some of the tech obviously is updated, but it's pretty spot on in terms of how they actually work.
How did that book come about?
Well, he asked me to do it.
Okay.
Like he's a very, you know,
how public radio is constantly having pledge drives and stuff, right?
Right.
Or it feels constantly, but it's like two times a year. So he's one of the few people in public radio, especially back in the past, although now definitely still the case that he's better at it, who makes it fun, you know, who makes pledge drives kind of entertaining. And he's always coming up with sort of funny things to do and doing special segments. And like, you know, he's just creative about what he does there. I mean, it's like he had two things in his mind at the same time, and I don't think he really realized he did. Like, one part was, I want to do a comic. I want to do something about how we do our work, because people are always asking us, you know, how we do this stuff. And the other piece of it was, oh, wouldn't it be funny and wacky if we had a comic book about ourselves, you know? And I don't think he really thought about how incompatible those two goals were. You know, because he's thinking like sort of superhero comic Biff Bang Pow kind of thing. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, it'll be so fun for the pledge drive. But in actual fact, I think we went much more and, you know, straightforward kind of comics journalism style. And really it was just designed to be this pledge drive premium. And then, you know, sell through, you know, I sold a few through my bi-published comics publisher, and they sold them through their website and stuff. And it really could have been like a flash in the pan kind of blip thing, you know, that happened in 99, and by 2000 it was like gone, you know. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, it was then and almost is now still one of the very few books that explicitly talks about the process of making narrative audio, and teaches it, you know, teaches how to do that and how to think about it. And so it became like the book that everybody read in order to learn how to do it. And I heard over the years from many people, meaning, you know, a half dozen or something, which is a lot since I'm not in the radio world, that this book had changed their lives, you know, had been something that, that got them on the road to being a producer, or helped them make their first piece, or, you know, some other thing like that.
Wow. That's great.
And, yeah. And so, and I knew from that, and just from, you know, I knew, you know, it was still on This American's Life's website for, you know, 10 years or whatever afterwards, still is actually, and still selling, you know, I'd get royalty checks every year, which is super unusual for comics in any, you know,
yeah,
in any scenario, especially at like a 32-page comic available only on one website.
Right.
So I was aware that there was not just a market for this, but like a need for it, that it was a real thing. And, you know, I felt like there's got to be more we can do with this than 32 pages. You know, we've got to be able to do a better job essentially than we'd done. And so I went back to him in 2011 or something and proposed working on another book. And his first answer was, nice to see you, Jessica. Hell no.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, it was just, you know, the process of putting together Radio and Illustrated Guide was like way harder than he imagined, because he's thinking comics equals fun and comics equals actually a ton of work. So he figured that out because he was working on it with me directly. So once we worked out the idea that he's not going to work on it with me, I was going to make this book and he was going to be a part of it in some sense. Like I interviewed him and he was a sort of a character in the book, and, you know, he wrote a foreword for it and so on. Or I guess a preface, not a foreword. So in that sense, he was involved, but he had very little, you know, to do to make it work. And then he's like, oh, yeah, good idea. So, and since then, he's been super supportive. Like, whenever he talks publicly about, you know, how to learn radio and so on, he'll talk about my book. And, you know, he's been really great about it. He's been really, he's very pleased, I think, with how it came out and the use that it has.
And is that book, does that book have a wider focus than just audio storytelling, or is it still primarily geared towards that sort of storytelling?
Well, technically speaking, it's very much about narrative audio, you know, mm-hmm. the specific cases, the people I'm talking about. So this is Out on the Wire. I don't know if I said the title of it. It's a book about, I guess there's 7 or 8 different podcasts and radio shows in the book, and about 35 different producers. And they're talking about how they do their business, you know, how they make these stories. But they're very, the ideas, like 90% of them are highly transferable. Mm-hmm. And very, very relevant for anybody trying to make stories in any medium. And so to a certain degree, I think people have gotten that. And like, there's some people who, you know, work in other areas who are definitely fans of the book and have read the book, but there's also like, you know, it's like, oh, it's about radio. It's not for me. You know, there's that stuff definitely happens.
Yeah.
And that was one reason why I did the podcast about it. I did the Out on the Wire podcast because that was explicitly designed to broaden the focus and say, look, these are storytelling principles that are applicable across the board.
So is the podcast, was it sort of like a self-contained series of them, or are you continuing? Are you still doing it?
It was self-contained.
Okay.
It was, it was like a, I guess there were 9 episodes and 8 workshop episodes. And we left it, we called it season 1, basically leave the door open for getting back to it.
Yeah.
Sure. But, you know, by the time we finished, we were like, okay, we're done with this in this form. You know, I could see doing other podcasting stuff at some point, but not, yeah, I mean, it had its own natural arc to it because it really was about how do you tell a story? Like, what, you know, what are the pieces and how do you build it? And when you're done sort of with that process, it's not like there's nothing else to learn, but I'd gone through the material I had, you know?
Mm-hmm. So then how did you get into writing about creative focus and inspiration and that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, they're all super related, right? And the main thing the direct reason, the number one reason is that I was with, so Out on the Wire, the podcast, if your listeners don't know what this is, it's going to be like totally baffling. You have to go like look me up like and figure out all these connections. So anyway, you have Radio, an Illustrated Guide, which came out in 99. And then in 2015, Out on the Wire, the Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio came out. And that is includes most of Radio, an Illustrated Guide as a preface or as a chapter 1 introduction kind of thing. And then it expands on that and talks about storytelling principles in a broader sense. And like, what are the big ideas that drive their work? Then I took that and adapted it into a podcast, where each episode of the podcast took a specific piece of the book and not just the book. It actually expanded on the book to a certain extent. And presented it in a slightly more directly pedagogical manner. Like, here's what your takeaway should be. Here's how you do this, as opposed to these are things people do, you know? Mm-hmm. And then there was a challenge at the end of each podcast episode. The podcast itself was a fully written, fully scripted, soundtracked narrative podcast. So not, you know, in interview style like this, but like much more structured.
Mm-hmm.
And then in between, so then we had an online group that was doing the work alongside the podcast as the podcast came out. And we would discuss their work like as we went through. And then in between full podcast episodes, we had workshop episodes where we would take work from our online group and workshop it live in live discussion between me and my producer and Matt Madden, my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are discussion episodes where we were like critiquing and talking about the issues that came up. And so in this online group for Out on the Wire, I was thinking about my next steps and what I was going to do. And I was thinking, oh, well, maybe I'll start doing some more like formal teaching about storytelling, which I may yet do. But anyway, I was thinking about it then. And I asked the group, I said, how could I help you do better in your creative life? And really expecting things like, well, you know, I really need help with building characters and story structure and whatever, you know, chapter breakdowns. And a large number of people just said, I can't get my work done. I'm procrastinating like crazy. I want to do these big things that I don't know how to do. And there's, you know, it's kind of a cry from the wilderness in some sense. And so I decided to start working on that essentially. You know, I thought this is something I actually you know something about. Like, I know how to organize work and get it done. I know how to not freak out about this stuff. And so I started working on that.
As somebody who's doing the writing about it, how do you ever have to go back and like read your own writing and remind yourself? Do you ever get caught in that same feeling of like, I just can't get anything done? And
I mean, I would say I have different issues from my average student. So it started out as a course, the Creative Focus Workshop, which I'm actually teaching right now. I'm in the middle of a cohort of that right now. And, you know, which is really an amazing experience. It's super cool to see things clicking for people, even people who are working professionals who are just things are not working, you know, their lives are not working out the way they want them to, you know, it just doesn't feel right. And like, it's too hard and they're too stressed out and they're trying to fix it. And so, having those people, you know, both people who are trying to make room in a life with a day job and whatever to just get something done on the side, and people who are that's the core of their life, the whole range, and just seeing them, kind of shake loose of a lot of the anxiety and a lot of the freak out about, you know, getting the things done and, you know, implement some systems and figure out what that means for them in their own lives. And I think that's why what I do is good for parents, because it's not the way I approach creative productivity has nothing to do with rigid rules. You know, it's all about working around and with your particular situation.
Right.
You know, taking what works and amplifying it, as opposed to beating yourself up because you can't run things according to, you know, like the train schedule.
Right.
So that's where it all started. And why did I start talking about this? Oh, writing it for myself. So anyway, the issues that people come to me with, usually in the Creative Focus Workshop itself, and you know, in the coaching that I do, are not the same issues that I have, because a lot of times it's just not figuring out how to break down projects, you know, feeling super overwhelmed by these things, like really being stuck and like not getting anything done, you know, those kinds of things. That is not my problem. Mm-hmm. I am a very productive person. but I have different struggles in also strong ways, I think I want to say, and also serious ways with not letting myself have margin, time to breathe and think and, you know, get strategic about things, and, you know, a whole host of other things that have to do with basically having gotten so good at productivity that I like scheduled everything out.
Too good at productivity.
Yeah, like, too good at productivity. I get stuff done, but I don't think enough. You know, I don't spend enough time like with myself.
Has that always just been your personality?
To an extent.
Yeah.
I mean, to an extent. I mean, I definitely was not productive at all when I was younger. That was not, this is not like always been me. I've always been organized and always been sort of like thought about systems and things, but I was like definitely super anxious and super like ineffective in the past. And mm-hmm. So I did have to learn these things, which is why I think I'm pretty good at teaching it, because it's not, I don't think it comes naturally really to most people.
You're also the mother of two. How old are they now?
They're 7 and 9, actually almost 10. She'll be 10 in a month. Yeah.
At what point were you in your career when you had children?
Well, I had been making comics for a long time. I was a published author. My daughter was born after we'd finished Drawing Words and Writing Pictures, and we were already we were about to become the series editors for Best American Comics, and that was a huge job for 6 years. My son was born in the middle of doing Mastering Comics. We were like up to our eyeballs. It was ugly.
So what was that transition to parenthood like for both of you?
It was ugly. It was fine. Like we worked it out and everything. And like, actually when my daughter was born, we were in a pause between two books. And so with her, we had a little bit of leeway that we'd sort of built in. But with my son, we had no, we had nothing. Yeah, it was tough. That was really tough.
Were you both working from home? I'm sorry.
Yeah, because we were both working. We were working on this textbook together, which just was a monster. It's just a huge project. And I mean, we were really like right in the middle of it and had to just kind of keep going with it. You know, I think we were working from home, although we were also both teaching. I took maternity leave from teaching for a semester in each case. But
were you able to take maternity, you know, quote unquote maternity leave from the book projects or?
Well, that's what I'm saying is with my daughter, I took a little bit of maternity leave, like, you know, I don't like being idle, so I'm not sure I stopped everything. This was a long time ago, too, so it's hard to remember. But, like, I stopped a lot, you know, and she's a December baby, so there's also the holidays. And, it's, you know, there's kind of a sense of pause there. Mm-hmm. But when my son was born, I mean, I might have taken 3 weeks off.
Wow.
And then, you know, again, like, I wasn't teaching, and I'm working from home. And, you know, there's lots of ways in which it was not – It wasn't like I was all of a sudden in the office for, you know, 8 hours a day or something like that. It's not the same as somebody who has a full-time day job.
Right, right.
But I was definitely working, like, immediately.
How did you, I guess when your kids were very young, how were you able to separate yourself mentally from the kids when, you know, and from whatever's going on at home when it was time for you to sit down and work?
Well, we did have a nanny initially with my daughter for a little while, and that was hard because it's just there's stuff going on in the house all the time, and we're working in the house. Mm-hmm. But basically, we put them in daycare as soon as we could, you know. And my son was in daycare part of the time by 3 months, and my daughter was in daycare by like 9 months. And I'm a huge advocate of daycare. I think daycare is amazing and awesome.
Yeah,
and I think that there's one of the things I found really distressing about becoming a parent is there's you know, and I'm sure this is like part of the thing you must talk about all the time, and especially as a creative person, is like there's so many expectations laid on women especially, but on parents in general, about how they're going to parent that they're just ridiculous. It's like it's like as if these choices are, you know, black and white or whatever. Like there's this whole debate about natural childbirth versus, you know, medicated. Mm-hmm. And personally, I am all about medicine. Cause, like, I would not get a root canal with, you know, unmedicated. I don't know why I have to, you know, like why in order to be a good mother, I need to have natural childbirth and experience like the worst pain that most women experience in their lives.
Right. Fully. Yeah.
It was plenty painful with medication, yeah. I can tell you. You know, I don't get why we need to do that. And I don't get why, you know, you know, there's a lot of women and I really respect the work that they do in terms of making sure that natural childbirth is an option for people, mm-hmm. and supporting people who want to do that. I think that's really important. I think it's really important that people get to make their own choice, but there's tons of, like, if you're an, you know, educated woman, you know, come from the sort of like upper middle class, either, you know, in money, but more importantly in sort of in an educational level, there's tons of guilt laid on you, you know, and lots of pressure around, you know, all the kinds of, you know, childbirth related things. And same goes for, you know, staying with your kid and, you know, spending time with your kid and, like, you know, versus daycare and all this stuff. And it's like my most important thing I can do for my kids, I think, is to be a happy person, a productive person who has a full life.
Yeah, agreed.
And who has them in it. You know, and like invites them into it and spends time with them, you know, being the person I am. I mean, I try very hard not to, you know, pretend that I'm all about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you ever have guilt about that?
I mean, I think there was some momentary guilt, but I'm pretty clear-eyed about these things for my, you know, and I have plenty of friends who do feel a lot of guilt about it. And I look at that and I'm like, I feel for them, you know, because I know, like, so hard, like, what if you're in that mode to kind of, it just was so clear to me that, like, if I were forced to stay home and stare at an infant for 10 hours a day, I would go insane. Like, I admire the women and men who can do that, but it's just not my personality. Like, I'm not a baby person that way.
Yeah. How did you and Matt handle the division of labor at home?
Well, other than, you know, breastfeeding and stuff, that's mm-hmm. not possible. It's been extremely even, or was extremely even, for a very long time. It was, you know, really right down the middle. And then since I've taken this job at PAFA, so I now have a full-time job and I'm also trying to juggle other responsibilities. Matt's really the full-time parent.
Okay.
And really full-time, and I'm trying to like come back in and sort of take some pressure off him because things are easing up for me slightly right now. But, you know, he cooks, he makes all the, you know, does all the shopping. He does all of the bringing kids to the activities. He does, doctor's appointments, keeps track of all that stuff. You know, he goes to the pharmacy, like he does all the stuff.
Yeah. Is it something that he is happy with, or is he interested in also working full time?
He does not want to work full time. He would obviously, I think, love to have, he likes doing this stuff more than I do. Like, he's more suited, you know, personality wise to being that the parent who does kind of the errands and the all that stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so he does like it, but I know he would definitely appreciate more flex and just more time to just concentrate on his own work. 'Cause he does do his own work, you know, working at home, like he had in the studio, like when the kids are at school, he's doing his stuff. But, I just don't think he definitely does not want a full-time job.
Yeah.
And I think he's basically pretty happy with this arrangement given our constraints.
Mm-hmm. When your children were born, you mentioned that you were both teaching. Were either of you teaching full-time, or like, did you have benefits of any kind?
Yeah, we had benefits because we were at SVA, which is a school that doesn't actually have any full-time faculty.
Oh, interesting.
It only has part-time faculty. Yeah. So as a result of that, their structures for their part-time faculty are better than most. You know, there's more benefits available once you've been teaching for like a year or something and you're kind of like on a regular schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're only teaching one class, you have access to health insurance. And we were teaching more than that, so we had, you know, better discounts on our health insurance. Still wasn't cheap, but it was, you know, it was something.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you had to go without, or had to sort of be on your own with buying health insurance at all since the kids were born?
No. Because we moved from there to France.
Oh, yeah. So talk about that. I do want to hear about that, you know, what brought you to France and how long you were there.
Well, things were just like trying to make a living as an artist, as a creative person, as you know, is insane. It's like totally hard. And we were putting together teaching and Best American and our advances for our textbooks and, you know, whatever other stuff we could scrounge up to make a living. And we had, you know, an infant and a 2-year-old. And it was a nightmare. Like, it was awful.
Yeah.
And we had some beautiful moments with our kids and there's some really great things that happened, but 2012 was just I'm not going to say the word I want to say because you probably don't want your E on your podcast, but it was not good.
Yeah.
And we just had to make a break. And the only way, you know, living in Brooklyn, the only way we could think of really to really get out of the situation we're in is to really get out. And we'd done this before when we were in our 20s, late 20s, moving to Mexico City. And we knew we had always wanted to try living in Europe. And we had this opportunity because there's this cartoonist residency in Angoulême, France. And we applied for that and got that. And again, because of SVA's structure, we had a sabbatical.
Oh, wow.
And so, which, you know, is not like it is for a full-time faculty because it was based on our hours, you know, so it wasn't like a full-time salary or whatever, but it was money, which was great.
Yeah.
And, you know, had some other things in place to kind of help make the transition work for us. And so we went and we ended up staying for 4 years.
What brought you back to the U.S.?
Well, you know, the residency ended.
Oh, that'll do it, I guess.
Yeah, like there's the time period, time limit on reapplication and stuff was 4 years. So we did 4 years, which is not to say we couldn't have stayed. You know, we could have found another way to stay, you know, or just decided to stay. But we felt kind of ready to come back. And then we got here and we're like, what did we do? but also, you know, I got this job and I did not know that was going to happen. That was a complete surprise. I mean, that it came up in the first place that I had this opportunity. And so we came back and live in Philadelphia now, where we'd never lived before.
How have your children handled the transition back here?
You know, they've been great. There have been moments that were rough, and they don't love school, you know, in general. And, you know, they have a point of comparison with the French schools, which are different. You know, for my son, it's kind of painful because he finished France in kindergarten, and it's just such an amazingly great little school that he was in. And his kindergarten teacher, who my daughter had also, was amazing. Like, she was just she's like a dream kindergarten teacher. And then he comes from that into first grade in a giant public school in Philly. Oh. So that was not good. But he, you know, they're both doing fine and sometimes more better than fine. You know, some things about Philadelphia they really love and their school they really love. And it's just sort of, you know, American public schools, it is what it is. You know, it's not like we are want to be in public school, but the emphasis on rote learning and worksheets and testing and all this stuff it's distressing.
Yeah, yeah. When I have younger nieces who we just saw them and their dad was talking about homework, you know, for the kindergartner, and I thought that's insane.
It's insane.
They're there for so long, and then they still have to.
We fight, yeah, and we fight about the homework thing. Not fight, but we talk about that with the principal and with the teachers and stuff. And we're known as the like homework protesters at school because you know a lot of parents are like, why isn't there more homework? You know, it's just so crazy. But the idea that you know the kids should be at school for you know all the day and then they come home and do worksheets. Like if it were this you know really high quality homework, you know, research projects and whatever. I mean, I would understand the logic anyway, because, you know, at least they'd be doing something, you know, original or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's just like worksheets and stuff and they're tired. So it's really, I'm not happy about that part.
Well, I think hasn't it been proven that when they're younger, it's more detrimental than anything? Like it's not good for them.
Yeah. I mean, yes. And we've handed that research out, believe me, and gotten some response. You know, definitely there's actually been a reduction in homework at our school, partly as a result of our, you know, mostly Matt, you know, his advocacy. But, you know, we're not like there's not this wave of protest at a school about homework. Just people think like more is better, you know, keep them working.
Right.
You know, some parents use it almost as a babysitter. You know, it's like a thing for the kid to do.
Right. That you don't necessarily have to do with them.
Well, because they're working or whatever. Yeah. You know, like our school is not universally, you know, there's plenty of people who are working class people who have to work a lot of jobs and, you know, long hours and stuff. So, you know, that's legit. But at the same time, like, just find something else, you know, just have them read a book or something. You know? But yeah, there's some different attitudes about what homework should be like that I find problematic for sure.
Do either of your kids draw comics or comic-like things, I suppose, for the five-year-old?
Oh, he's seven, but yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. They do. I'm sorry. I don't know what I thought.
Yeah. Seven and nine.
Seven and nine.
Yeah. He draws stuff that's comic-like. I mean, he draws a lot. She draws some, not quite as much as she used to. They certainly read a lot of comics, so... neither of them have done really fully developed comic stories or anything like that. But definitely sequence comes into things and different kinds of storytelling stuff. Sure. Yeah.
What's some of the early comic work that they read and enjoyed, or do you have some that you would recommend for kids, you know, first starting to read them?
Well, I mean, one of their favorite stories that they still really like, but they were just obsessed. And my daughter especially was obsessed with it when she was like 5 and 6. And we were reading it to her. She wasn't reading it on her own, but it would also be good for older kids reading it on their own. Is this series called Sardine in Outer Space. It's a French comic translated in, some of it's translated into English. It's probably out of print, but it's available. And hilarious, really funny stuff. The kids loved that. But they also, they like Tintin, and there's a series called Ariol. It's Ariol, A-R-I-O-L. It's about a, I believe it's a donkey, a child, you know, like tween or something going to school. It's like school stories, but the character is a donkey.
Oh, okay.
And all the, you know, the other animals, the other children are other animals, not the only animal. That's a really good one. There's just so many. There's so many great comics.
Yeah.
They love Raina Telgemeier's books, all of her books, Smile and Drama. And
I was just thinking about Sisters, buying that for some nieces and kids that are just old enough to handle that.
Yeah, it'll be a hit. My son's read Smile. Like, he just picks it up and reads it again, like whenever it's in front of him.
Oh, that's great. Like,
he just over and over again, he's read that. All of them, but especially that one. He'll bring all four of them down and just like read half and like leave it open on the, you know, couch or whatever. And I'm like, are you done with that? No, I'm not done yet. But yeah, that's how he reads. He gets all the comics out and like reads half of them and leaves them on the couch.
Has your creation process changed at all since having children, or has the content of your work changed?
I mean, it has, but I'm not sure. It's hard to pick out like what's sort of, what part is responsible for it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's changed massively. Part of it is like having children was kind of the last piece of the puzzle in terms of being more productive and figuring out how to regulate my time. Because you have to be more conscious and careful about your time when you have all these extra demands.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, parents in general, they may feel super overwhelmed, but they, especially parents of small children, probably get more done than the average person because they, you know, it just may not feel like it because what is it that they're getting done? Is it satisfying? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I think they get good at it for sure. And that was the case for me where suddenly I like had a regular schedule, you know, I would have to get up here and, you know, be someplace at this time. And, you know, instead of having the artist schedule of like kind of do stuff whenever. And limits on my time. So in that sense, I got better at it. And that certainly also contributed to the work I'm doing now with Creative Focus and Growing Gills. So we didn't actually say that, by the way. So the Creative Focus workshop started the whole thing for me, although it was a pilot program initially. And then last winter, I turned that work into a book called Growing Gills.
Oh, okay.
How to Find Creative Focus in your, when you're drowning in your daily life. And you mentioned that book earlier, but that's like for your listeners, like that's the full circle.
Okay.
But so the content of my work has changed hugely in the last 10 years, but I think it would for anybody in that amount of time.
Right.
You know, and just the mere fact of, you know, pivoting away from being, you know, trying to make a go of it as a full-time author, essentially, to, you know, having a business and running a course. And now I'm a full-time faculty member and, you know, all this other stuff. It's like, it's very different. I don't think it has a lot to do with the children directly.
Yeah.
It's just sort of the way life works, I think.
Yeah. In the comics world, did you ever feel like you didn't want to be seen as a mother as it relates to your work?
I think so. But not in a, like a, I don't want anybody to know I'm a mother way, but I feel like it's kind of nobody's business.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm happy to talk about it, but it's not a, like, I'm not making work about being a mother.
Right.
Particularly. I mean, there's certainly some mothers in my work occasionally. Yeah. I don't know. Like it didn't feel all that relevant. You know, it's, to who I am as a cartoonist.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with social media and photos of your kids, whether, you know, personally or as it relates to your sort of public persona?
Well, certainly my public persona, there are no pictures of my kids. I don't post pictures of my children. Mm-hmm. And as an individual, I really don't either. Like a tiny bit, like there's a couple pictures of my kids from years ago on blog posts, like old blog posts, which I actually have been considering taking down. And Matt occasionally will post pictures of them from something, but he always takes them down after, you know, a week or whatever, whenever he's got a chance, you know, sort of in our circle has got a chance to see them.
Oh, okay. That's an interesting tactic. I like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not super secure because if anybody wants those pictures, they're going to, you know, get them or whatever. But that's not really the issue. It's like, we don't need this archive of stuff out there about them. Yeah, no, we just don't talk about it, really.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to jump back to when your children were very young. What did you do, if anything, to prepare for children financially or otherwise? And is there anything you wish you'd done differently?
Before our children were born, before my daughter was born, we lived in an old row house in Brooklyn, and there were lots of renovation that we had done already. We were doing it over time, and I made sure, because this was my baby in that sense, before I have my baby. and I made sure that certain things were finished and wrapped up before she was born. So we had an upstairs bathroom that we redid. Oh, and we redid her room. We did the room that she ended up sleeping in for a few years. And hated every minute of it. She was always trying to escape. So we did that, and financially we were in a reasonable position. I mean, we had some savings. Like, we didn't have like a specific baby budget. We knew we would have support from our families if we needed, you know, big things or whatever, and, you know, had a baby shower and kind of got the pieces that we needed in place in that sense. I mean, we didn't do a ton. What would I have wanted to do differently? Well, I'm glad I did do that renovation, because that would have been a nightmare. So I'm happy that happened, that I managed to get that done. I don't know. There's just, having a kid is a different order of magnitude in change in my life than I'd ever experienced before. And I don't know that I was prepared for that, but I don't know that there's a way to prepare for that. And, you know, financially, I don't think we realized how expensive childcare was going to be. And we had fairly inexpensive childcare, as such things go. We were living in a less expensive sort of immigrant neighborhood. And so, you know, used, childcare, you know, daycare that's for people in that neighborhood, therefore it's sort of priced accordingly, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Like her first daycare was, Chinese speaking. And then she went to a like Dominican, daycare later, sort of Spanish speaking daycare.
Okay.
And they're both great and totally not fancy. You know, and had their own issues, but like really sweet people and like really nice. So that was part of how we solved that. But it still was like, it just like, we didn't do the math on what that number was going to be. And it was shocking, like how much money it was. And it was sort of shocking to me that we could come up with it. Like, we managed to come up with it. I don't know how we did that quite. But you kind of do what you have to do, I guess. So it would have been good to have that number understood. Like, I don't know if there's other things I could have done to like soften the blow.
Yeah.
The biggest change for me, you know, financially, obviously it's a change, times change, but just the sense of like the change of identity of like, you can't just make decisions on your own about what you're going to do. And like the restrictions of not being able to, go out and be a grown up the way you used to be able to do, mm-hmm. you know, that was something I hadn't fully absorbed.
Yeah. Giving up the freedom is
and would it matter if I had? I don't know. Probably not.
Yeah.
You know, still would have had a kid, and I still would have had that experience. So,
yeah. Well, like you said, there's only so much you can do to prepare for it, if there is anything, for the emotional impact.
For yeah, the emotional impact and just the lifestyle change impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the things that are going to change for you as far as how your life is going to look, you know, day to day, week to week. That's just, it's just massive. And I think that, you know, when I see people who are thinking about having children, you know, it's like such a cliche, things are never going to be the same again. You know, your life will change totally and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, so that's true. and you just need to think about like what that is for you, you know, and make sure that you're ready for that change to happen.
Okay, great. Is there anything that's coming out in the near future that you want people to know about?
I guess the next thing I have coming out is Trish Trash, Roller Girl of Mars, Volume 3 will be out in the spring, I guess.
Oh, great.
And yeah, but other stuff is, you know, it's all still available, you know, widely available books and things. So all findable. And I'd be happy if anybody wanted to see any of that.
Jessica, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day. And it was lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, no problem. It was nice to talk to you too. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, Jessica, for being on the show. It was really interesting to hear from someone who has taken such a difficult career like comics and turned it into a really unexpected and fruitful path. I hope you've all enjoyed season 1 of Creative Playdate. I know you're going to love season 2 even more. If you aren't already subscribed, please do so that you won't miss the new season. And if you haven't done so, please take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. It helps me spread the show far and wide. The show is syndicated on Illustration Age, and our theme music was created by Thomas James and Jason Ritz. You can follow me on Twitter at Miss Illustrator and Instagram at M. Condrich. Thanks again for listening and sharing with a friend. Now go play.